talk about the nature of grief and loss, to talk about the danger of creating enemies, and to talk about the response of compassion to loss and violence. And I want to start off actually by talking about a personal experience, which many of you may know, but on Rosh Hashanah, just after Rosh Hashanah, we have a fast day called Tzom Gedalia. Tzom Gedalia is a kind of peculiar fast day, because unlike basically all of our other fast days, which are directly connected in one way or another to the destruction of the temple, Tzom Gedalia is a commemoration of the assassination of Gedalia, who was the ruler of Israel. Right? At the time, during the time of the Babylonian conquest, he was appointed by the Babylonians to rule Israel. And under his rule, a number of Jews came back to Israel. There was a sort of a small ingathering of the exiles. And upon his assassination, the vast majority of that community, fearing Babylonian reprisals, fled Israel to Egypt. And it was really only with the assassination of Rabin that I, for the first time, felt and understood the significance of Tzom Gedalia, of why we have this fast for the murder by our own people, again, by a Jew, of this leader. And in the Gemara, it talks about this. In Rosh Hashanah, it talks about Tzom Gedalia, and it asks, you know, well, why are we doing this fast at all? Why is this Tzom Gedalia so important? The Gemara says, to teach you that the death of the righteous is equal to the burning of the house of God. Right? That when we lose the righteous, it's like the burning of the house of God. It's like losing the temple. And yet, of course, and there are Rishonim may ask this question, well, what does that mean exactly? I mean, unfortunately, of course, we lose righteous people all the time, right? And that's happened many times in our history in different ways and in tragic ways. We don't have a fast for each one of them. And what I feel like this parallel is saying is that the term tzaddik here is not just about righteous, but it's about us losing our center. What happens when we lose our center? When that thing which felt like it was our center, it was our anchor, it's that which held us together, is lost. And that's really the parallel, I think, between the loss of Gedalia and the loss of the Beit HaMikdash. The loss of the Beit HaMikdash is this profound tragedy and suffering because we felt like, and we did, lose our center. We lose that which felt anchored and secured and safe in a certain way. And that was the experience of losing the leader of Israel. And I think for those of us who were, you know, for those of us who remember Rabin's loss, I think that was the experience, this national experience from the experience in Israel of losing Rabin. That there was a sense of the center had fallen out for a moment. That how had this project, this beautiful project we were all involved in, this project of Eretz Israel, become turned all of a sudden into this killing of brother, of this man who had been, who had demonstrated tremendous courage in both war and in peace, and who was, for whatever extent you agreed or disagreed with him, who was the Rosh HaMemshalah, who was the leader of Israel, right? Who was the Nasi, who was the person who stood at the center of this polity and this nation, was taken away from us. And I think, for those of us who remember that, you can remember that experience, but I think there's something profoundly scary and unstable when we lose our center. In whatever way do we do that, right? When whatever it is that we feel is our anchor or is our support, is that place for resting on that face of surety, all of a sudden falls away. And it happens in our lives, of course, in all sorts of ways. It reminded me when I was thinking about this, probably know it, but there's the famous poem by Yeats, The Second Coming, which is really written in the aftermath of the First World War, Right? So again, written actually concretely in the aftermath of this profound destruction, and not just destruction, but loss of center. I mean, one of the things about the First World War was the first kind of war in which mechanized mass slaughter happened. You know, it was sort of it was a totally different kind of war than had ever been fought before. And it profoundly shook up at least Western civilization and society. So he writes, I'm sure you know some of the words, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." And that at least that stanza of the poem, for me, so speaks to that loss of her being. That feeling of being denatured, of stripped, of losing our center, of feeling like the best have lacked all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. And often when we encounter that, when we encounter the loss of our center in some way, we can have a response, which thankfully wasn't the response then, of giving up, of despair. And we have that response sometimes when we lose our center as a way to kind of protect ourselves from future loss. It's like, that was too painful. That was too painful to lose whatever I lost there, to lose that center, to lose that one anchor of security. And so I'm going to respond by stopping that option from happening again, from closing down. And so the first part of our working skillfully and mindfully with losing the center, with the loss of Rabin and all the implications that had for Israeli society, for peace, for our next steps forward, is really to be able to grieve, to really allow the grief and the loss to move through us and to be present in us. Because when we don't do that, we turn into that which we oppose. We turn into anger and resentment and hatred and violence and protection and tension and being closed. Denise Levertov has a poem called "Talking to Grief." She says, "Ah, grief, I should not treat you like a homeless dog who comes to the back door for a crust, for a meatless bone. I should trust you. I should coax you into the house and give you your own corner, a worn mat to lie on, your own water dish. You think I don't know you've been living under my porch? You long for your real place to be readied before winter comes. You need your name, your collar and tag. You need the right to warn off intruders, to consider my own, my house your own, and me your person, and yourself my own dog." We need to become intimate with our grief, to give it a place to sit within us, to really allow the mourning to happen, but to do that in a way that we don't get caught in what could have been. We don't get lost and caught in the trap of the past, right? It could have been this, it could have been that, if only, right? There are a lot of if onlys. Those thoughts arise. I mean, it arose for me. I noticed that because it arose for me. It was like thinking about Rabin and thinking, if only, where would we be now if that hadn't happened? And so grief is fully acknowledging the experience of the loss without at the same moment rejecting that which is true at the moment, which is the loss, right? We fully accept the loss by fully acknowledging and feeling it. And when we do that, one of the reasons it's so crucial to do that, to really welcome in the grief and the loss when it happens, to welcome that feeling of uncertainty, to welcome in, which is just as connected, the experience of fear, right? It's the fear, it's the anxiety that this may happen again. In the grand scheme, but in the little scheme, it's like, I just lost my center, I don't know what to do, I feel confused, And oh shit, that means that might happen again. Because that's the nature of this human life, right? It happens, and it's like, oh, that might happen again. What do I do with that? So often what we do with that is we respond by resisting. We respond by making that loss and that problem into an enemy. And then we just reproduce the very cycle of grief and anxiety and fear. And I want to make that very particular now about what I'm talking about. So again, as people may or may not remember, depending on how old you are, before Rabin was assassinated, it didn't just happen out of the blue. It wasn't just sort of an empty space. There was a whole culture and a politics, at least in my view, and I think pretty clearly, of dehumanization and demonizing that was taking place politically in Israel on the part of, in this case, the right. And Rabin was shown in, you know, placards as a Nazi, as an Arab terrorist, right? So a whole place of turning this person, a political opponent, into an enemy. And so the actions of Yigal Amir was not just some random person acting, and of course he didn't act alone. There was a group of people acting with him. But the origins of his actions were rooted in ignorance and aversion. They were rooted in ignorance, in demonizing the other, right? In not seeing the other as fully human, whoever that opponent is. And in the fear, hatred, and anger which he and the group of people working with him felt towards Rabin and his policies, right? Felt threatened, felt opposed, angered, hatred, aversion. And the question is, and the danger, even when we do like a memorial like this, is how do we not do the same to Yigal Amir? How do we not turn Yigal Amir into the demon, into an enemy, right? Which is not in any way to not be clear about the terrible thing he did, or to excuse it, or to not have consequences, right? But it's to recognize that this person too, when he acted in the way he did, acted from rage and confusion, from hatred, from ignorance, from his own certainty that he was doing the right thing. And that rage and hatred and ignorance and certainty that we are doing the right thing and making the other person into the enemy is present in each one of us. Each one of us right here has that inside of him. We have that capacity, and sometimes we have it actually as an expression. You can actually just ask yourself that question right now. Can you feel that in yourself? Can you remember a time when you had a desire to strike out in violence? When you had some kind of righteous anger at someone that you thought was doing something terrible, a political enemy, a personal enemy, a criminal, somebody who's hurt you terribly, right? Not saying that you've necessarily done it and hopefully we had the wisdom not to act on that, but just noticing the desire. Or maybe you're involved in the politics of Jerusalem right now. Right? There's stuff happening right now. And maybe you have all kinds of feelings towards the people that you don't agree with, right? Which is not to stop you in any way, but being clear about your disagreement and standing up and supporting what you think is best and right. But it is about saying, how do we not turn them into the enemy? How do we not turn them into a demon? Right? And I know I'm talking about this, I'm not talking about it for you, right? I'm talking about it for me, for my own experience, right? I had an experience, I was just thinking about it today, someone not that long ago, it was a few weeks ago, certain person, character, who had been a really difficult person in my life recently, been really like not nice to me, obstructive, made my life really hard. And I remember having the feeling of, like, wanting him to die, right? Like, that was the feeling that arose. Like, I wanted him to die. Now, of course, like, I wasn't going to do anything. I don't obviously on my like on my reasonable mind. I don't really want him to die, right? But just noticing that urge arising, like, want that person to just die. Like, can they just get out of my life? Can they just stop hurting me? Can they just stop obstructing me? Can they just stop being difficult, right? And so our task really is to recognize that we have that peace inside of ourselves. And when we recognize that in ourselves, to allow it to give rise to compassion. Compassion even for the enemy. Compassion even for Yigal Amir, right? For his own suffering and confusion. Because shutting our hearts doesn't help us. And it's challenging for me to say that, right? To like admit, like there's a part of myself which is like, no. Don't have compassion for him, right? But there's another part of myself which recognizes, and who is that helping? Right? Who is that helping if I don't have compassion for them? How does that help me create the world that I want to see? And then to allow that recognition and compassion to lead us to the commitment to heal the conditions which created a Yigal Amir, right? Which created that kind of hatred and violence in the first place. It's like what it says in the Gemara in Brachot, famous story, beautiful story, with Bruri and Rabbi Meir, right? And Rabbi Meir is really angry about some guys who are giving him a really hard time, right? He's really upset. They're giving him a really hard time. And so he wants to pray that they should be eliminated. They should no longer give him a hard time. And Bruria, in her wisdom, says, no, no, no. You can't play ki yitamu chotim min ha'aretz, ele chata'im, right? It's not that sinners should be removed from the earth, but rather sins. You're praying not for their removal, but for their transformation, right? You're having that wisdom and compassion to see, yes, maybe they're doing some terrible, really harmful things, but what we want is the situation to change. We don't want to hurt the people themselves. The judges in Yigal Amir's trial wrote, this is part of their decision, they wrote, every murder is an abominable act, but the act before us is more abominable sevenfold, because not only has the accused not expressed regret or sorrow, but he also seeks to show that he is at peace with himself over the act that he has perpetrated. He who so calmly cuts short another life only proves the depth of wretchedness to which his values have fallen. And thus he does not merit any regard whatsoever except pity, because he has lost his humanity. How do we not lose our humanity? The cry for vengeance won't do it, right? But the movement of repair of tikkun will. There was a Tibetan monk who was imprisoned and tortured in China. For those who are following the news at all, you might know that there have been some recent massacres in Tibet. And he eventually was able to escape, and he was interviewed. And they said to him, you know, how, when you were tortured, and you were saying, how did you not hate the Chinese? He talked to him right in here, he said, like, he didn't hate them. He said, how do you not hate the Chinese? What they're doing to you? And he said, you know, they took everything from me. They took my freedom, they took, like, food, pain, they took everything from me. I wasn't going to let them take my humanity as well. Right? There's something tremendously courageous in that response, which says, I'm not going to give in to the anger and the vengeance and the hatred, because I'm not going to let my humanity be taken away. I'm not willing to pay that price. It's like it says in Mishlei, right? Bin fol evecha al tismach. Don't rejoice in the fall of your enemy. Because that anger and vengeance, the spite and the hatred, they never bring real healing. They might give a temporary victory, and that happens, and whatever the problem is, whatever the situation is, they might, right? And it's important to acknowledge that, because it doesn't help us to be like, say like, oh, and if we feel those things, nothing ever happens, it never works. It's not true. It works sometimes, right? If feel hatred, you feel anger, you do something, you get a temporary victory, something happens, something changes. That is true. But not a permanent one, right? It never fundamentally changes the nature of the situation. We get caught in those feelings often as modes of self-protection. And we get caught in them, and that's why I started with what I started. We get caught in them because we're not willing to truly grieve. And as we're not willing to truly acknowledge and see how much we have been hurt, and to really open to how much we have been hurt. We're trying to protect ourselves from feeling the hurt, and it's much more comfortable, strangely enough, but you can check it out in your own experience, it's much more comfortable to feel angry than it is to feel the pain. It's much more comfortable to feel the desire for vengeance than it is to feel just how deeply betrayed or hurt we feel. Right? It's much more vulnerable to feel that betrayal and to feel that hurt. And it doesn't mean we can't oppose things, right? I just want to be totally clear. It doesn't say anything about our ability to stand up to things, to take action, to make things stop. But it's the question of how we do it. It's like the Balatanya says. He says, we oppose the evil in the person, the resha in the person, and we love the divine in them. Right? So it doesn't mean you can't oppose somebody. You can oppose somebody with all of your might, and it's something crucial that we have to do, right? But you don't have to turn them into a demon. You don't have to turn them into the enemy. Right? Doesn't matter how much you oppose them, you don't have to turn them into the enemy. That's that crucial piece, the crucial difference. And when we do that, then we can start to act, and we can act from the place of compassion. And we should act, right? I hope this call, at least for me, of the Yom HaZikaron for Yitzhak Rabin is a call not just to notice what's happening inside, but a call to act in the world, to say, things maybe aren't going so well here in Israel in certain ways, right? It's not all working out. We lost this person who was trying to do his best to make it work out, and what can we do now to play our part? How can we take some concrete action to make a difference? And that might be in whatever way is possible for you, you know? Maybe politically, maybe personally, maybe lots of different ways. But really asking yourself, what can I do in his memory to make a difference? But when we ask it that way, when we're not caught in hatred and vengeance, then we can act with passion and without despair. What I mean by that is, we can know clearly that we may fail and that others may work against us. Because that's the nature of what happens when we act for things. We might fail. In fact, we undoubtedly will fail in some of the things we do. That's the setup, right? That's what happens when we act for things. We're going to fail sometimes. But we don't have to let the fear, which is the fear of the failure, the fear of hurt, the fear of disappointment, stop us from acting, right? As long as we're actually willing to be present with it all, we don't have to make it stop us from acting. We can act with courage and conviction. We can act with the passion, which as Yeats said, you know, he said, it seems like only the worst have the passion. The best can have the passion without letting the passion trap us in the feeling of despair and loss when things don't work out the way we want them to. And so the way we act, when we act with this skill, Pizetner says, is that we prepare ourselves, and then we let God act through us, right? It's a kind of action, a deep passion, and an effort, which is at the same time effortless. It's like we're just opening and we're asking to sort of listen and hear, how do we act? What's being called on to act through us? The Magid of Mezrich says, it's like a shofar. We become a kind of empty vessel to let the divine voice just flow through us. He says, when I really speak with wisdom, I just open my ear to hear the divine voice and let it speak out of my mouth. So what does that mean as we come to the end in this very short exploration? It means that we acknowledge that we're not in control and that we're not powerless. And you can see that right in your practice, Practice is great for teaching you that. You cannot control what arises. You can try, but you'll fail, right? Give it a shot. It's a great thing to experiment with it. You can't control it, actually. You also can't control when you wake up. You're lost all of a sudden. Oops, oh wow, you just woke up and noticed that you were lost. Cool, right? You didn't do that, right? You actually cannot control it. But you're not powerless. You're totally not powerless. There's a lot you can do, right? You can cultivate attention. You can return. You can soften. You can enhance the effort. There's tons you can do, but you're not in control. We learn that in a very concrete, moment-to-moment way in the practice. And then we bring that awareness into the rest of our action in life. It's true also in the political arena, in the arena of justice, of trying to change this world. We are not in control, and we are not powerless. We don't have to give up, and we don't have to everything sort of waiting and relying on the fact that it's all going to work out the way we want it to. And in that way, sort of going back to that question of grief and making enemies, it's less about blame, and it's more about creating the conditions for love. It's about seeing where the conditions for hate have arisen and doing whatever we can to try to uproot those conditions and water the seeds of love. And that starts right here. Right here at this very moment in our practice. Because every time we come back with compassionate presence to our breath, to this present moment, every single time we come back, we are watering in that moment the seeds of love. And we are letting go in that moment of the seeds of hate. So let's just take a moment to sit together and water those seeds of love. Thank you, everybody, for your kind attention. A few technical notes, and then hopefully if you have a minute or two for some questions. First, in 2 weeks, basically, we have a retreat. We're going to put out some flyers on the table out there. Please take one and hang it somewhere, and please think about joining us. Retreat is an extraordinary opportunity to deepen your practice, to really open in a way which isn't possible in mundane practice and normal life. So I strongly, strongly encourage you all to come. All the information for the retreat is here, and we'll put those out there on the table out there. Also on the table are two other things. One is an email sign-up sheet. There is a Google group just for this class. If you're interested in finding out when this class is and isn't meeting, for instance, unfortunately, the last 2 weeks I was sick, so we didn't meet. Please write down your email address. You'll be added to the Google group, and you'll just get updates as to when we're meeting so you know what's happening. This class is also by donation. Nobody pays me to do this. So please give generously. Whatever you can is really appreciated and help support this teaching and this practice. So let's just take the last 3-4 minutes together. We're just going to open it up. If people have questions, things they want to share, parts of their experience, the floor is open.
I find that often when I move into a place of compassion for those who have views that are abhorrent to me or people who really annoy me, like whatever it is on both ends of that spectrum, it slips into pity. Mm. It slips into emotions that feel slightly paternalistic.
Yeah. Yeah, great. That's great. Right, so what's the difference between pity and compassion? Pity is, look at that poor person over there who's suffering. when I'm over here, right? And compassion is, oh, I see suffering right in front of me, and my heart is quivering in the response of compassion. And I see that that is not separate from me. It doesn't mean that I have to pretend that I'm experiencing the same thing they're experiencing right now. I'm not. That's fine. But I see that it's not like they're some fundamentally other. So this is a good example. It's like, oh, this person has views abhorrent to me. Oh, those views are coming from his hatred and anger and self-protection. Oh, right. I too have hatred and anger and self-protection, right? So the movement of compassion sees that essential connection between me and the person I'm feeling compassionate for. That those pieces, especially in this kind of sense, those pieces are also in me. They're also in me in some way. Which doesn't mean that, you know, we've experienced the exact same thing that person has experienced. It's fine. They'd be experiencing something very different from us. It means that we're acknowledging our fundamentally shared humanity, and we're not treating them as fundamentally other. The suffering isn't over there somewhere. It's kind of right here. And right now, this person is experiencing it, and my heart is just responding in the quivering of compassion to their experiencing that suffering. And we can have compassion at the same time for the suffering that their mistaken views or actions are causing, right? It's not like we have to have one and not the other. Like, in that suffering and seeing, oh, I see ignorance and anger, I feel compassion for that person who is trapped in ignorance and anger, and I also feel tremendous compassion for the suffering that that ignorance and anger is causing. That's just wise and clear, right? No need to sort of let go of that. We're feeling compassion for everything that's arising.
I'm sort of wondering, I feel like a lot of times, it's not necessarily that people I don't understand or disagree with them because they have some opinion that's based in like pain or suffering. Rather, they really believe what they're saying. You know what I mean? Like, right, you sort of positioned in a strange way where anyone you disagree with is obviously suffering.
Yeah.
Which I don't think you intend to. I assume you don't intend to.
Well, I do intend that, actually.
Oh, okay.
So let me go back and say what I mean by that. Look, there are different levels of it, so that's true. So first of all, I may just disagree with somebody, and we might just disagree on some technical aspect. What's the best way to do this thing? What's the best way to implement some policy or way of being? Which can be a genuine disagreement, that's right,
intense.
And hopefully in that situation we can recognize, like, I really think I'm right. I may be wrong. They really think they're right, right? How do I not turn it into hatred and anger towards them? Absolutely.
That's right.
But also, sometimes we're seeing people who are acting in ways which, from our own judgment, it's not that we're just disagreeing about like how to do an action. We think something is fundamentally flawed in their values, right? Like, they're actually out to hurt certain people. That's true, right? Some people, they're out to hurt people in certain ways. And we think that's a bad or harmful thing. What I'm claiming is that any time we're out to hurt somebody, them and us, it's not particular to them, right? It's coming out of ignorance and aversion and craving. That's always the case. Now that is, like, of course, a huge statement. I don't have time to really sort of lay that out and try and explain why I think that's the case. Next week, actually, as I introduce the practice, I'm going to explain a little bit more why I think that is the case fundamentally. But the fundamental claim there is that our fundamental nature basically is open and loving. And we're only when we're responding in protectiveness and ignorance about the nature of who we are and who others are, in counter-distinction to our fundamental natures, when we act with violence and ignorance and hatred and hurtfulness towards the world. Now, I'm not asking you to accept that, right? And I certainly don't have time now to actually sort of lay that out to you in a way that may or may not feel convincing. What I'd suggest, is don't worry about anything I just said. But just check it out in your own experience. Like, just check it out for yourself. When you act in ways where afterwards you're like, ooh, that wasn't the best way to act, right? Like, I just hurt somebody or I just hurt myself. Just investigate. What happened when you acted in those ways? What were you experiencing inside? Where was that action actually coming from? And my suggestion is, and you can just check it out and see if it's true for you. My suggestion is that every time you investigate a way that you have acted in a way that you are not proud of and you are not happy with, you will see that it came from actually some mode of self-protection inside, some mode of trying to establish your own sense of safety, of not being hurt, of aversion, of wanting the things you want and not being denied the things you want, of ignorance, a mistaken view of your own self and holding on to protecting your own self. That's what I'm suggesting. And it's just like, experiment. See if it's true. You might be like, no, that's really not true. That's cool, right? Just experiment and check it out and actually investigate your own experience. So thank you very much, everybody. Lovely to see you again. And I will see you all, hopefully, next week.